A plot to overthrow Michigan's government and kidnap its governor fails, but the presence of white supremacist terror remains.
13 members of two militia groups who are preparing to kidnap and possibly kill me.
I'm Tanzina Vega, and today in the Takeaway for Monday, October 12th, we're breaking down the rise of right-wing militias and the threat of domestic terror. Plus, hundreds of thousands of women left the U.S. workforce in September, but Latinas have been disproportionately affected by that crisis.
During recessions, Latinas do tend to be more affected. They tend to suffer greater economic losses during recessions like they did in the 2008 recession. And unfortunately, it takes them longer to recover than it does other groups.
Also, today's installment in our series, A Votar, looks at the Puerto Rican vote and how that could factor in come November. Okay, everyone, let's get started.
The individuals in custody are suspected to have attempted to identify the home addresses of law enforcement officers in order to target them, made threats of violence intended to instigate a civil war, and engaged in planning and training for an operation to attack the Capitol building of Michigan and to kidnap government officials, including the governor of Michigan.
That was Michigan Attorney General Dana Nessel speaking last Thursday. Last week, more than a dozen white men linked to an anti-government right-wing militia were arrested after plotting to kidnap Michigan Governor Gretchen Whitmer and overthrow the Michigan state government. And the arrests are just the latest example of the growing threat of militia extremism across the United States. While federal law enforcement officials say they consider these groups to be a major threat to domestic security, the Trump administration has shown no signs of condemning these groups so far. Here's Governor Whitmer from her press conference last week.
Stand back and stand by, he told them. Hate groups heard the president's words not as a rebuke, but as a rallying cry, as a call to action.
For more on the latest from Michigan, I'm bringing in Dustin Dwyer, a reporter with Michigan Radio. Welcome to the show, Dustin.
Thank you for having me.
What extremist militia groups are these 13 men affiliated with?
Well, according to the charges, they were affiliated with the group they called the Wolverine Watchmen. That was a group that seems to have been created by this group of men because they didn't really fit into any of the other groups. I spoke to one militia leader from a militia called the Michigan Home Guard, and one of the ringleaders of this group who's now been charged with terrorism and kidnapping, he was in the Michigan Home Guard and got kicked out because his views were too extreme. He was too aggressive, and he was thought to be an unstable person. And so he got kicked out of the Michigan Home Guard and then linked up with these other men and created the Wolverine Watchmen.
Dustin, how common are these militia groups in the state of Michigan?
They're very common, and they have been for years. There are many different militias, and people in the militias in Michigan have been trying over the past week to sort of distinguish between this group and that group. You know, you have groups in some militias coming out with statements condemning these 13 men, but the militias are really all over the state in Michigan.
What exactly is the distinction that these other militia groups are trying to make here? I mean, these are obviously, these are, from my understanding, these are folks who have deputized themselves to somehow mimic law enforcement in many ways, but they are not officially deputized by anybody to actually carry out any of the things that they say they want to do. So what exactly are these groups trying to distinguish? How are they trying to distinguish themselves?
Well, when you talk to them, so the way they explain it to me, and again, I talked to the leader of the Michigan Home Guard, and he said, look, we're really just about protecting our family. We're about arming ourselves to protect our family. And they say, you know, we're here to help the community. They talk about giving out water in Flint and responding when the dam collapsed. And they see themselves as sort of these private citizens who go out to help. Meanwhile, they're just carrying these, you know, really large guns as they do so. So in their minds, at least, there's a big distinction, and they've been trying to draw that distinction since this all happened. In reality, what a lot of people on the outside see is, you know, these huge rallies that were happening at the Michigan Capitol. All these people were mixed together, side by side. I mean, the people who have now been charged with terrorism were standing side by side with these other people in the other militias who say, you know, they're the good guys.
What happens now, Dustin, to these folks? These are 13 white men, I believe, who were arrested in this plot to overthrow the Michigan government and also to kidnap Governor Whitmer. What happens to them now?
Well, all 13 men are in custody. Six of them are facing federal charges. Seven of them are facing state charges. There are hearings on Tuesday, preliminary hearings for some of them. And they will be in custody, you know, pending whether they get bonded out or something like that. But now it's a court case. It's you know, they're facing some pretty heavy charges here.
Among those charges, I mean, how much time could we see these folks doing if they are, in fact, convicted of the charges?
I think it depends on the charge, but terrorism charges, they could be serving a long time in prison. But of course, their lawyers will come out and say, you know, not all 13 were the ringleaders here. Some of them had different roles in this plot, and they, of course, will try to negotiate it down. But we'll have to see.
Tell me a little bit about what the sense is in Michigan among the folks that you're talking to, everyday Michiganders. How are they seeing what's been playing out?
I think everyone's been shocked by it here as well as, you know, anywhere else. It's shocking, but in certain ways, almost surprising, because for some people it confirms what they already believed. As I said, there were these demonstrations in April and again in May where a lot of people were shouting things and holding signs that said nearly the same things that that has been charged in these documents. I mean, there was one man walking around the Lansing State Capitol with a doll with dark hair, which looks like our governor, and there was a noose around its neck. So some of the imagery and some of the rhetoric doesn't seem surprising at all. But when you look at the details of how far they got in this plot, it's pretty shocking.
Dustin Dwyer is a reporter with Michigan Radio. Dustin, thanks so much for joining me.
Thank you.
The plot to kidnap Governor Whitmer is just the latest incident involving right-wing extremist groups across the country. For more on the bigger national picture, I'm going to bring in Heidi Beirich now, who's the co-founder of the Global Project Against Hate and Extremism. Heidi, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Also with me is Daryl Johnson, the owner of DT Analytics and a former senior analyst at the Department of Homeland Security. Daryl, thanks for joining me.
Thank you.
Daryl, let's start with you. The modern militia, at least, movement dates back decades here in the United States. But where have we seen some of the sharpest increases during the Trump presidency?
Yeah, so when I was at Homeland Security, we actually started seeing the recruitment of this second wave of militias going back to 2008 when Barack Obama was elected president. And the reason why we saw that rise is because typically during Democratic administrations, militias are fearful of gun bans and gun legislation. They're also fearful of minority rights being expanded, particularly immigrants. So we saw this rise actually begin as far back as 2008, but it's taken on new increases with the Trump administration, which kind of goes against all the trending data that I've seen over the past four decades. Typically during Republican administrations, the militias don't have those same fears as they do during Democratic. And so this kind of bucks the trend. And it's, I think, linked back to the president's rhetoric.
And when you say the president's rhetoric, Daryl, you mean that he has not outwardly condemned these groups or that he has said things to encourage them?
He's actually done both. He hasn't condemned these groups in any way when they've been participating in violence and plotting terrorist acts. But also through his tweets, we saw the president tweet out things like Liberate Michigan and Liberate Virginia back when they were having the anti-quarantine rallies. He's also, used other Twitter messages to kind of send out a signal to these militia groups that they're operating in a permissive environment and that the president, has their back.
Heidi, we're understanding a little bit more about these groups as we go, but who are these groups? I mean, what is their dynamic? Are these violent white supremacist groups? We heard earlier at the top of the show, our reporter Daryl, who's in Michigan, was saying that these groups have been around and some of them are trying to distinguish themselves. But how do we generally define, quote unquote, militia groups?
Sure. I think there's a big distinction actually between the militias or anti-government groups, which is the broader movement, and white supremacists, in the sense that these aren't necessarily organizations that have overt racial messages. Now, there are racial messages within this movement. Daryl just mentioned anti-immigrant feelings, anti-Muslim feelings, but they're not groups in the way that white supremacists claim that the country should be run entirely by white people or that we should have a white ethno-state. So I think that is a distinction that makes a difference.
So then how are we describing militia? What are the characteristics here? And is militia even the right term to use, Heidi, given that this group in particular who threatened Governor Whitmer was planning to overthrow the Michigan state government and kidnap its governor?
Well, in general, anti-government groups are motivated by fears of having their guns taken away, sort of conspiratorial ideas like the government's going to come and round them up and put them in camps. They talk a lot about arming themselves in case there's some sort of constitutional usurpation that occurs. In this case, I think this particular group had come to see Governor Whitmer and the Michigan government as having basically overthrown the constitutional system, and they were going to take her out and do something to restore that. These groups talk a lot about how the Constitution's been violated and that they need to do something to reimpose kind of an imagined past when that Constitution was functioning.
But that imagined past, I mean, are they considered, Heidi, a domestic terrorist?
In many cases, militias have been involved in domestic terrorism, not just this particular case in Michigan. There was an earlier case against something called the Hutari militia also in Michigan that was involved with possibly plotting against law enforcement. We had arrests of an Alaska militia that wanted to kill cops and judges. So there's a lot of terrorism that comes out of these groups.
Daryl, in your experience, as a result of what Heidi was just saying in terms of the terrorist activity that comes out of these groups, how does law enforcement tend to view them? Do they make a similar distinction between militia, quote unquote, militia groups and white supremacist groups, or are they all seen as threats to domestic security?
So federal law enforcement defines a militia as two or more people that possess and use firearms, conduct paramilitary training, and espouse anti-government rhetoric. So that's the definition. After the Oklahoma City bombing, the FBI's Behavioral Sciences Unit put out what's called a militia threat topology, which categorizes militias on the basis of their criminal activity as well as their rhetoric. So they have categories 1 through 4, 1 being the least threatening and 4 being the most threatening. So what differentiates the 1, 2, 3, and 4 is basically the level of paranoia, whether or not they're committing criminal activity, and whether that criminal activity involves terrorism or terrorist plotting.
And given what you heard about this group in particular, Daryl, would you say that they fall into that category?
Yeah, they would definitely be a Category 3 group because they're two or more people possessing firearms, conducting paramilitary training, espousing the anti-government rhetoric. They're committing, criminal activity by plotting the kidnapping of the governor, and they actually took steps to go to the governor's residence and conduct surveillance. That would be a Category 3 group.
Daryl, we've heard about the Proud Boys and the Boogaloo movement here in 2020. Curious, what makes those groups different from what else we've been hearing about with these militias, for example?
So the Proud Boys are basically a group that like to agitate at different protests. They can devolve into street fighting between protesters and counter-protesters. So that's more of a kind of a state and local problem. It's not rises to the level of a terrorist group. Whereas the Boogaloo movement, we've had a number of incidents recently. Despite the fact this movement's only existed for about a year or less, we've had shootings, fatal shootings of police officers out in California. We've had, terrorist plotting in Las Vegas. We had an individual in Michigan in Madison Heights that gotten gunned down by the FBI for pulling out a weapon on them when they attempted to arrest them. So this is a movement that wants to basically take advantage of the civil unrest that's ongoing and try to exploit it and try to cause more civil unrest and destabilize society to hopefully start a civil war, basically.
Heidi, I was hearing about this potential for a quote-unquote race war back in 2008, after President Barack Obama was elected, to Daryl's earlier point here. But this, I mean, polling, let's take a look back at Michigan here, because polling is showing that a lot of Michiganders are actually supportive of Governor Whitmer's restrictions, for example, on the coronavirus. So where is all this anti-government sentiment coming from?
Well, it's been around for a long time. I mean, we can trace this back to the 1990s. There's always been a segment of folks, especially in Michigan, that have been vehemently anti-government, don't like the federal government, although that's changed with the rise of President Trump, and that, you know, view any kind of measures like Governor Whitmer's taken as restrictions on their constitutional freedoms and something that they should fight back against. And we saw very quickly, just after a few weeks of lockdown, these massive protests in several states, including Michigan, against the quarantines and the lockdowns.
Heidi, one of the big concerns here as we head into this very contentious presidential election just a couple weeks away is what's going to happen at the polls. I want to play a clip from President Trump right now.
I'm urging my supporters to go into the polls and watch very carefully, because that's what has to happen. I am urging them to do it.
Heidi, that was President Trump saying he's urging his supporters to go into the polls and watch very carefully. What can we take away from that, Heidi? Is the president inciting some of these militias to do, quote unquote, poll watching?
I'm quite worried about exactly that, that Trump is signaling to his supporters, like he did back in late April with those liberate, you know, North Carolina, liberate Virginia, liberate Michigan tweets, to say to them that they should be at the polls. You know, heavily armed folks standing in front of poll areas will be extremely intimidating and quite scary. And you have to worry also about people who will be activated into acts of domestic terrorism. I think people forget that we had four such acts around the 2018 elections, and this is an even more fraught environment than that year. So this is kind of scary.
And Daryl, to that point, I mean, one of the things that we're hearing is that the president is, you know, really sowing doubt about the legitimacy of the election results. He's been doing this for quite some time, as he's begun to consistently trail in the polls. Could the president, you know, could violent militias, Daryl, act on this and interfere with the transition of power if, in fact, you know, the president continues to sow this type of doubt?
That is definitely a possibility, and we're entering a period of heightened risk of things like this happening because, you know, these narratives of, you know, potential voter fraud, rigged election, you know, these are code words that the militia interprets as, you know, the president being, you know, illegally taken out of power or something like that. And so, you know, if the Republicans end up losing the White House, then there may be people on the outer fringes, because they've been, you know, told this fearful narrative, may turn that into action.
Heidi, I want to just close here by a little bit. Michigan Attorney General Dana Nessel last week said that what she's witnessing, what she's seeing in Michigan, and I'm quoting right now, is not just a Michigan problem, it's an American problem. What does she mean by that, Heidi?
Well, we have had an incredible amount of terrorism coming both from militia-type groups and white supremacists over the last several months, and this is something that's widespread all across the nation. Daryl mentioned the possible attack on social justice movement in Las Vegas by Boogaloo Boys, cops being killed by Boogaloo Boys. This group had connections to that particular movement. That is happening all across the United States, and this is such a fraught period. It is very possible that we're going to see even more violence. Thank God this plot was broken up, but we don't know what's to come.
Daryl, we've got about a minute left. What are your concerns as we head into the election?
My concerns are not only the ones that we've already discussed, you know, the voter intimidation, the potential terrorist acts following Republican loss, but we also have to worry about when these protesters and counter-protesters get together, they could pull out guns on each other and you know, shoot each other or start a gun battle.
And we're seeing the concern about that, of course, is growing and growing. Daryl Johnson is the owner of DT Analytics and a former senior analyst at the Department of Homeland Security. And Heidi Beirich is the co-founder of the Global Project Against Hate and Extremism. Heidi, Daryl, thanks to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Since WNYC's first broadcast in 1924, we've been dedicated to creating the kind of content we know the world needs. In addition to this award-winning reporting, your sponsorship also supports inspiring storytelling and extraordinary music that is free and accessible to all. To get in touch and find out more, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.
Hey everybody, I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway at the start of another big news week. We're going to be talking about the economic recession that the coronavirus has spiraled into in just a few minutes, and specifically how it's affecting Latina women. Spoiler alert, by the numbers, it's pretty awful. So we asked you, Latina listeners, how it's going and whether your work circumstances have changed because of the pandemic.
Hello, my name is Kim, and I'm a Latina from a large southwestern city in the United States of America. And I had been working full-time throughout the pandemic from the time our governor put restrictions on local businesses in March up until June. And I started having issues with wearing a mask and doing my job. Long story short, I've been out on medical leave without pay. I am getting short-term disability insurance at about 60% of my base pay, which I'm just barely squeaking by, and I totally understand that it's a whole lot more money than a lot of people get. But long-term, I just don't know how I'm going to go back to work. I don't know what my financial situation is going to be. But during these quiet times and these uncertain times, I'm spending time with family. I'm in the park with my niece right now, and we're doing paint-by-numbers. And I'm enjoying every day to its fullest, whereas before I used to look forward to a vacation or spending time with family, and now I enjoy every single moment of it. Thank you so much.
Hi, my name is Connie. I'm calling from Santa Rosa, California, and I am Latina working in this community where I work as a nurse practitioner. I've had the privilege of working remotely during the pandemic. Unlike many of the patients that I serve, the vast majority of cases of COVID-19 in the patients I care for has been among my Latinx patients who have jobs as cooks, janitors, and the like that they cannot do from the safety of their homes. As a Latina, it's been especially hard to witness how this disease has disproportionately affected the Latinx population within my own community.
Hi, my name is Desiree Favela. I'm calling from Buckeye, Arizona. I happen to work in a caregiving field. So for me, this pandemic has not changed my circumstances as far as not having work, but my hours have become longer and there is a greater need. And we are in great need of more people who are willing to stand up and help others during this time. We have one of the only programs in Arizona who teaches people with no medical training how to become caregivers so that we are able to serve as many people as we can. We are devoted, and we do all believe that we are devoted guardians. With the right PPE and training, I believe that we can get through this safely.
Hi, my name is Tina, and I work with senior citizens in Palm Beach County. So I'm still working actively all my regular hours, and I don't want to bring any disease home and affect my family members. However, at work, not everybody sees it the same, so I'm having to protect myself constantly. It's a little frustrating when you stay home during the weekends and you don't really have any life outside of here, trying to protect your clientele, and then the person sitting right next to you at the desk has been out all weekend and traveling and doesn't care for masks. Trying to keep my family safe, but it's definitely a stressful time.
The coronavirus pandemic has brought an economic crisis that disproportionately affects women, and it's only getting worse. According to a report from the National Women's Law Center, 865,000 women left the workforce in September, And of those who dropped out, close to a third were Latinas. According to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, the unemployment rate for Latinas in September was 11%, compared to 6.9% for white women. For more on this, I'm joined by policy analyst Elsa Macias, who recently authored a report for Hispanas Organized for Political Equality that looked at the pandemic's economic toll on Latinas in the United States and in California specifically. Elsa, thanks for joining me.
Thanks so much for having me.
As we mentioned, hundreds of thousands of Latinas have left the workforce during the pandemic. Why is it happening in such high numbers for this group in particular?
Yeah, it has been really disheartening to see what's happening with Latinas specifically. We found that they were the group that was most affected by job losses, especially through May. And part of the reason is that they tend to be overrepresented in job sectors that were most affected. So, for instance, in the retail sector, in the accommodations and food sector. So, for instance, they tend to be overrepresented in food services, nail salons, housekeeping, and hotels. And those are the sectors that were most affected during when the non-essential businesses closed. So if you have a 42% drop in jobs in those sectors, and you have these women overrepresented in those areas, then they're going to be most affected. But in addition to that, we saw that it was the women more so than the Latinx men who were affected. So there's something happening here. This is not a trend that we've seen for the first time now. We tend to see that during recessions, Latinas do tend to be more affected. They tend to suffer greater economic losses during recessions like they did in the 2008 recession. And unfortunately, it takes them longer to recover than it does other groups.
Why is that? What are some of the structural factors at play here? Because we are in a moment where we're really looking at structural inequities and structural racism and structural sexism. So what is it about this group of women, Latinas in particular, that creates that environment?
I'm glad you mentioned that, because even when we did control for some of the factors that were problematic, we're still left with some structural inequities. But some of the issues that that do come into play are that Latinas tend to have lower levels of education. And so they're less protected when there are economic downturns. They tend to be in jobs that are more impacted by job losses. So they're not going to be in the kinds of positions that are going to be protected for longer in the economy. They have lower levels of education. They also have, as I said, they're overrepresented in certain sectors. You know, we also found, we didn't do this particular analysis nationwide, but in California, we also found that it was undocumented women who were most affected. So if we're looking at what happened in May, for instance, the unemployment rate in California was 16.4%, something like 29% for Latinas, but it was 36 and a bit for undocumented Latinas. So it was much, much higher for undocumented Latinas. So that's another issue that comes into play. They also are less likely to be able to work remotely. So one of the big things that happened for most of us who were fortunate to be able to retain our jobs, we were able to work from home or work remotely, however that may be. And Latinas are less likely to be able to do that. So if they can't work remotely, if you're working in housekeeping at a hotel and the hotel is closed, it isn't something that you can do from home.
Elsa, does sexism play a role in any of this, Elsa?
Well, we think so. We think that, as I said earlier, even when you control for some of the factors that may be at play in the higher numbers for Latinas, you still are left with some differences, some disparities that you can't explain in any other way other than through structural inequities, through sexism, and through racism. We see that the employment rates are not as affected for Latino men as they are for Latinas. So we're left with the only other explanations that we're left with are perhaps our sexism and racism.
And what about when it comes to wages, Elsa? Have we seen those who have remained employed also have wage decreases?
There have been wage decreases in various areas. I mean, even for some emergency care physicians, so certainly at the higher levels. But again, when you're looking at Latinas, they've been devastated. And that's just adding to the existing wage gap, which we also have. the wage gap is really egregious for Latina women compared to men in across the U.S. The average Latina makes 54 cents for every dollar made by a white man.
And we should note that that's also the lowest among all women of color. Latinas are disproportionately the lowest paid, aren't they?
That's right. So they tend to have fairly high workforce participation levels, but they're paid really poorly. And again, if we control for education, if we control for other factors, we still have a wage gap. And that's a wage gap that is still much lower than the 79 cents on average that the white woman gets compared to every dollar a man makes. So again, even controlling for all of these other factors, we're left with the fact that there's probably some sexism at play here. There are probably some structural inequities, again, that are being faced. And so you have women who already have less money. They tend to be less wealthy. Latinos in general tend to be considerably less wealthy than the white population. They have less savings even before a recession hits. So even though across the board, Latinas have been doing much, much better on many metrics, particularly on education and as business, small business owners, they are much more vulnerable as a group. So they are doing economically much, much worse at this point even than most other demographic groups.
We talked a little bit about undocumented women, but I'm wondering what happens to this population for people who are undocumented or people who are citizens in terms of getting economic relief from the state or federal government. We know that for many Americans, the unemployment benefits have run out. Eviction moratoriums are also running out. What does this tell us about the Latina population, whether they are documented or undocumented?
Well, they're facing some very dire consequences in the next couple of months. And in fact, and not just them, I mean, it's across the board. There's something is going to be happening in the next few months as those housing moratoriums are lifted. So these are people who are much less likely to reach out for help, especially if you're undocumented. In California, the undocumented population had access to some assistance of $500. And remember that they did not have access to unemployment relief, which others look to as a lifeline. They didn't have that. And a lot of them were afraid to reach out to get the benefit that was made accessible to them. When people tended to reach out, it was usually out of desperation. A lot of these people are also more vulnerable to housing losses because they're more afraid complaining, of saying, hey, this is not something that's acceptable. They're more afraid of reaching out to legal aid. So they're extremely vulnerable. They've been more likely to lose their jobs. They tend to have fewer resources, fewer savings, and they also tend to have fewer resources in terms of where to turn for assistance. This is a population that is extremely vulnerable also because they're more likely to take pretty much any job that they can, more likely to face the consequences of contracting COVID and of dying. So here in California, although Latinos are 39% of the population, they are 61% of confirmed COVID-19 cases and 49% of COVID-19 deaths. You know, in any direction that you look, really Latinas are a group that is really, that are really suffering, even despite the fact that they're doing so much better or had been doing pre-pandemic so much better on several metrics.
And Elsa, do we know, is there any breakout on women who are Latinas who are white collar women? I mean, a lot of white collar women have also had to make accommodations and leave the workforce unwillingly because of the pandemic. Is there any information there?
That's right. I don't have specific data for that. But one thing I can tell you is that we polled Latina business owners, small business owners, and they reported that they were, for the most part, taking the lion's share of household duties and childcare duties while their children are now at home. So if they're lucky enough to still hold a job or if they're lucky enough that their businesses are still existing, then they still have, they're still coming, they're still taking on the lion's share of responsibilities at home. So it's an enormous amount of pressure. The same thing goes for all women. We have found that for the most part, women do tend to take the greater responsibility. If you have your kids at home, then that means that, that you've got that added you're trying to, you know, you're trying to do your conference calls online and do your work online while you're also trying to make sure that your kids are getting a good education. So it really does add up to a lot of stress. I also wanted to point out, by the way, that Latinos have been overwhelmingly, disproportionately affected by issues in the educational field. We already know that students, K through 12 students, are already about 9 months behind. That's one full academic year just from what they missed in school last year, March, April, May, June. And it's really heartbreaking because we expect that that's going to be a trend that's going to continue, since these are children who have Latinos tend to go to under-resourced schools, and that means that they're going to have access to problems accessing the internet, broadband. They're probably going to have teachers who are unprepared for remote learning. These Latino students have less support for English language learners and their Spanish-speaking parents. So, we don't know what it's going to be like this year, since obviously some schools are trying to do a better job, but we expect that Latino students are going to be falling even farther behind than they already are.
Elsa Macias is a policy analyst. Elsa, thanks for joining me.
Thanks so much for having me.
This is The Takeaway with Tanzina Vega from WNYC and PRX in collaboration with WGBH Radio in Boston.
In the lead up to the 2020 election, just weeks away, we're taking a look at the Latino vote in this country. It's a special series we're calling A Votar. And today we're zeroing in on the Puerto Rican vote. And as with many things, it's complicated because Puerto Rico is a U.S. territory. And while all Puerto Ricans are citizens by birth, those who live on the island cannot vote in federal elections. Those Puerto Ricans who are on the U.S. mainland, however, can vote. And that puts a big spotlight on the Puerto Rican diaspora in terms of its political power. With the backdrop of compounding crises, including the 2017 Hurricane Maria, where 130,000 Puerto Ricans left the island, the financial crisis, a series of devastating earthquakes, and a political crisis that took down the island's governor, there's a lot to talk about. Joining me now is Nicole Acevedo, digital reporter for NBC News. Nicole, thanks for joining me.
Thank you.
So we said there are 130,000 Puerto Ricans have left the island. Where do they live now, Nicole? Where is the diaspora concentrated?
Well, the diaspora is concentrated in mainly three states, New York, New Jersey, and Florida, which is a swing state, especially in election year.
Let's talk a little bit about Florida, because we know how important it is. I myself was in Florida a couple years ago for the 2016 election, talking to Puerto Ricans there about their vote. But as we mentioned, so many things have happened since 2016 on the island that have affected the Puerto Rican population writ large. What does it look like in Florida right now for Puerto Ricans? Are they being courted to vote?
I mean, they're trying. You know, we have parties like the Republican Party with Latinos for Trump that have been rallying Latino voters in the state for the past 4 years, really, because even though the president was just elected, the party sort of knew that he was going to run again for re-election. And for the Democrats, it's been a little bit lagging because they just this year, they said that officially their nominee was going to be former Vice President Joe Biden. So you have a time advantage there that it's really significant when it comes to rallying voters. I wanted to remind people in the last midterm, when we had a Senate run between Rick Scott, who was the governor of Florida then, and Nelson, Senator Nelson, and Rick Scott took the win that year, and it was a really thin win. And arguably, you know, Puerto Ricans that had recently moved to the state after Hurricane Maria, seeing how Governor Rick Scott then reacted to them and welcomed them, really made a difference. So I think that's a really interesting case study to really question the role of Puerto Rican voters and not just assume that because they're Latino, they're going to vote Democrat.
Well, and it's a very interesting time because since that election, Nicole, the crises on the island have only continued to increase. We're now seeing the island is dealing with a crisis in education, violence against women, the coronavirus issues. I mean, just compounding one after the other. And this president, President Trump, has had a mixed record when it comes to providing aid for the island. He was roundly criticized for his response to Hurricane Maria by throwing paper towels at many Puerto Ricans who were suffering. Puerto Ricans cannot vote from the island. They will have to vote from the mainland. What is your assessment, Nicole, about the Puerto Ricans who are here on the mainland, the diaspora, and how excited they are to cast a vote for President Trump or for Joe Biden?
I mean, there's no denial. You know, we saw President Trump in his response, especially last year, vocally opposing funding to Puerto Rico. We had members of his administration from agencies that are very important for the recovery that's going to take decades, you know, saying blatantly in congressional hearings that they were intentionally stalling funding for rebuilding homes in Puerto Rico. So there's no denial about that track record. But at the same time, when Puerto Ricans move from the island to the States, it's a completely different thing. When you grow up on the island, you're not really familiarized with the party system here in the States or how the elections work. They don't even learn about the Electoral College. So it's also a learning curve that is not just necessarily, hey, you know, support this candidate. It's just, you know, even getting civically engaged in the first place. It's a steep, you know, learning curve. And that's why it's timing, it's everything. But when it comes to voting, a recent poll said that Puerto Rican voters in the States were more hesitant towards voting in person, and they were leaning more towards voting by mail.
And that's probably because of the virus, right, Nicole?
Exactly. So we have a lot of people that are embarking in that process right now that are voting as we speak. And I think that, you know, they're still deciding, you know, when they see debates and they don't see Puerto Rico being mentioned, that may play into some things. Maybe they remember.
By neither candidate, we should be clear. I mean, we're not hearing Puerto Rico really in the conversation right now at all.
Absolutely. And you know, especially in a place like Florida, you know, we really have to sit down and think about that. A place where Puerto Rican voters could make a difference. You know, why isn't Puerto Rico part of the bigger conversation as we speak?
And I want to talk a little bit about that, too, because after a year after Hurricane Maria, we on The Takeaway went to the island. Many people there were talking about the theme of the island being resilience after the hurricane. A year later, in 2019, we spoke to a roundtable of Puerto Rican leaders who said that was about resistance. This was when Governor Rosselló was about to be removed from his position. Nicole, what would you say the theme is this year for Puerto Ricans politically?
I think it's a decisive moment. We have seen Puerto Ricans embark and survive all these crises. And this is the first election in which, you know, Puerto Ricans really have to sit back, remember all those moments, see who were the people that were there and helped, see who was not there and did not help, and really make decisions based on that, because whoever gets elected, whoever they vote for in this election, will determine many things for the future of Puerto Rico when it comes to its recovery and its fiscal crisis.
Right now, I think there are double the number of Puerto Ricans on the mainland, on the continental United States, that there are in the island. If I'm not mistaken, there are about 5 million or more Puerto Ricans here in the continental United States. Will that turn into votes at the end of the day?
I mean, you're absolutely right. You have like nearly 6 million Puerto Ricans living on the island, whether they've been here for a long time or they just moved here recently. I mean, that's always a big question. You know, how much of that diaspora really votes? I think that there's so many things that have happened in Puerto Rico right now with all these compounding crises that we've been talking about. And I truly believe that for the voter on the states, on the diaspora, it's very clear how the people they vote for here really have a say in the lives of their loved ones on the island. And I do think that may drive up voting turnout. The question is, you know, how much more it would drive it. I really think that's still to be determined.
Let's talk about the issue of Puerto Rican statehood, Nicole, because this is something, as with a lot of things regarding the island, that's been batted about as a political football, I think, particularly as this country heads into its next election. There have been people who say in the federal government who say that Puerto Rico and Washington, D.C. should become a state for political purposes. Puerto Ricans have had plebiscites for many decades now. Where do they stand and how realistic is that, Nicole?
I mean, I think that the issue with that conversation in an election year, their territorial status, is that it's very heavily politicized because the political parties on the island are based on that. The people that believe on statehood, the people that believe on the status quo, people that believe that Puerto Rico should be independent. And it really gets tainted by the politics of parties just staying alive. And I think that this year, what we're seeing is that, you know, regardless of what ideology you may have, that's not something that's going to happen quickly. That's not something that we're going to see in the next decade or maybe in our lifetimes. So people are really focusing more on, you know, saying, okay, how can I make sure that, you know, our fiscal crisis gets resolved, that's been straining so many generations of Puerto Ricans for decades. Now with the recovery, how do I make sure that this recovery, you know, it's not stalled for the next decade, two decades, and then we never see that money go into our communities and help people's lives. So people are being more aware that you know, it's not as easy as, you know what, if we were a state, we wouldn't have this problem with the federal funding. I think people are being more critical about that right now. So even with the plebiscite that's happening on the island on November 3rd, it's usually, historically, we've seen that's a tactic from the pro-statehood party to rally its base, because they're excited to vote in favor of their ideology. But I think the Puerto Rican voter wants more than that at this point.
Nicole, thanks so much. Nicole Acevedo is a digital reporter for NBC News. Thanks for joining me, Nicole.
Thank you.
Okay, I'll talk to you soon. Bye.
Bye.
All right, everybody. Thanks for joining us on this Monday. It's always great to have you with us. We'll be back here tomorrow, as always, and we want to give a big shout out and congratulations to the LA Lakers for winning their championship. If you missed anything or you want to listen back again, you can check out our podcast. And of course, you can call us about anything at 877-8-MY-TAKE. That's 877-869-8253. Or you can tweet us at The Takeaway. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Tanzina Vega. This is The Takeaway, and we'll see you tomorrow.